raise your hand or make some sort of an indication. And if we lose visual, I guess we'll probably all know that you've lost visual, but hopefully things will go well. They have been working just fine. So I presume the morning will go smoothly. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jason Steck, and I represent the appellant Klingel Hutch judgment. One of the comments that I heard from a judge that stuck with me was that we don't have debtor's prison in this country. And one of the reasons that it stuck with me was because it highlighted the distinction between a debt and the enforcement of the debt. A debt exists potentially in perpetuity, even though it might become unenforceable. But we have laws and statutes that limit the enforcement of the debt. We have laws and statutes that limit, for example, the methods that can be used for enforcement, that being homestead exemptions or the constitutional prohibition on collection of a debt in Minnesota. But we also have statutes, and that's the issue in this case, limiting the time during which a debt can be enforced. Now, that difference is important here because what's being limited by the statutes is the time for the enforcement of the debt. It's the enforcement period that's being limited, not the existence of the debt, but the enforcement period. Judgment renewal is a type of enforcement, and that's established pretty clearly in the Shamrock case that's cited in our briefing in note 2, when it's stating that all actions to enforce a judgment must be commenced within 10 years of the entry of that judgment. Now, that's what the respondent is relying upon here. But it also says that a civil judgment may be renewed by the entry of a judgment in a new civil action commenced within the statutory limitations period for enforcement of the original judgment. So what's being defined in the statute is the period of enforcement. Now, when does the period of enforcement...
Let me just stop you, Mr. Steck, because I understand the relief that is sought in the complaint that you filed in this case is that a new judgment or a renewed judgment be entered. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
So then why would we ever go beyond the terms of Section 541.04, which is the statute that directs or that provides... the length of time during which an action can be maintained on a judgment?
Because the phrase entry of judgment in that statute is ambiguous, and that's highlighted by the way it's referred to repeatedly in case law. When does entry of judgment complete? Now, the respondent's going to argue that it's complete in the second step of the three-step process, that there's an order for entry, there's entry, and then there's docketing. But almost all of the case law and the purpose of that of those statutes shows that the purpose is to limit the time period for enforcement of the judgment, which does not begin until that three-step process for entry of judgment is complete with docketing.
Well, Mr. Steck, I'm not sure where you get a three-step process. I mean, when I look at, you know, for example, Rule 58.01 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, it makes it pretty clear that, you know, a judgment is entered when the court administrator, you know, files it, you know, is entered and signed by the court administrator in the judgment roll. Our court in the certified services case made the distinction between, you know, the entry of judgment and the docketing of a judgment, which is a completely separate thing. So I'm not sure what authority you would rely on to somehow make this entry of judgment into a three-step process.
Well, what I'd ask the court to look at would be the statutory language in 548.09, which is the statute that the district court here focused exclusively upon, when it says the judgment survives and the lien continues for 10 years after its entry. But it also says that the lien does not exist until docketing. So there's a distinction to be made between entry as a step in the process and entry as a process at all, overall. And the only way to make sense out of all these statutes is to treat entry within the statutes as the process, not the step called entry. That the process of entry has to be complete.
Mr. Steck, if we look at 541.04 by itself, I mean, it uses the term entry. It does not make any reference to docketing, correct?
That's correct, but we have
to- why must we look at another statute that refers to both entry and docketing?
two reasons. Number one, the district court referred to this statute exclusively in its decision. It did not refer to 5.
I have a question about the background of that. I guess which statute or statutes did the parties cite in their motion papers before the district court?
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't recall. I think it was both.
But did each party cite both, or did one party rely on different statutes than the other party?
I honestly don't recall, Your Honor.
Does respondent own real property in Ramsey County?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, at least not that we're aware of.
I mean, isn't that a necessary, isn't the ownership of property in the county a predicate for the application of 54809, or no?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I don't believe that that's an issue that's part of the record. I don't know where Mr. Klingelhut's owns property.
So I'm looking at, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm looking at subdivision one from the time of docketing of the judgment. From the time of docketing, the judgment is a lien in the amount unpaid upon all real property in the county then or thereafter owned by the judgment debtor. And it goes on. But it seems to me that that statute might be invoked only if the debtor owns property in the county. Otherwise, it would be irrelevant.
It's not irrelevant even if there isn't property. And it's for the following reason. And that's the second reason that we have to focus on both statutes, not just 54109 exclusively. And that is that it's a core component of statutory interpretation that we read statutes so that they get along with each other, so that we don't have statutes that wind up contradicting each other in different situations. So if this court was to focus solely on 54109 to say that under that statute, then which wasn't the core of the district court's decision, that entry began that the enforcement period began upon entry. In another case where there was where it was in the record that the judgment debtor owned property in the county in question, suddenly 54809 would have a different statutory period for enforcement of the judgment. The two statutes would not define two different periods. And that's not how we're supposed to be interpreting statutes. We're supposed to be interpreting them as defining the same 10-year period, not different ones.
Well, but I mean, I understand the canon, but that makes sense if we might interpret one statute to look at the following section. You know, it's two statutes that are close together, or two statutes that are both in play in a particular case. But here, this other statute that you're relying on is in a completely different chapter and for a different purpose. And I'm not even clear if the purpose of that statute is relevant to this case, I guess, it seems to me it would only be relevant if the judgment debtor owned real property in the county.
But Your Honor, the text of 54809 does not support that limitation. It says the judgment survives and the lien continues. So it is defining, 54809 is stating two things. It's saying that survival of the judgment exists for 10 years after it becomes enforceable, and the lien continues after 10 years after it becomes enforceable.
If there is a lien, but there's only a lien if there's real property in the county.
But even if there's no real property in the county and there is no lien, the statute then says the judgment survives for 10 years after its entry.
Mr. Steck, the statute, this is Judge Larkin, and I've got to go to my other screen to look at the language. There we go. I'm not understanding why that last line of subdivision one of 54809 doesn't mean that the judgment is entered, it therefore survives for 10 years, and the lien, if any, is valid to the extent of that 10-year period. And I don't understand why we wouldn't read it that way and why that wouldn't be consistent with, what's the other one here, 54104. In other words, I'm reading both of those things to say you enter the judgment. That means the judgment's alive for 10 years. Within that 10-year period, you can docket it and enforce it. I'm not understanding how a new 10-year period would start with the action of documenting. Am I misunderstanding the language?
With respect, Your Honor, yes, because the previous sentences in Subdivision 1 make clear that no lien exists until docketing is done. Mm-hmm. Which means that when they're saying the judgment survives and the lien continues for 10 years after its entry, entry then is being treated as after the docketing happens.
Why is that? Why can't we have entry and then docketing, and then the docketing creates the lien, but the period of the lien starts with the 10 years that flows from entry?
Well, because that's literally never been how it's been interpreted before. On page 11 of the appellant's primary brief, we cite several authorities going back more than a century that state that treat the date of completion of entry when the enforcement period begins as upon docketing, not upon the second, merely the completion of the second step called entry. So it's never been interpreted that way before.
Mr. Steck, I have a question for you. Back in the Certified Services Inc. case back in 1988, our court held that entry of the judgment triggers the appeal, the running of the appeal deadlines, rather than docketing. Why would a different rule apply to triggering the 10-year period during which an action may be maintained on a judgment? In both instances, it's the judgment itself, the decisions that the district court made prior to ordering entry of judgment that are being challenged.
Well, first of all, I'd say that the court's procedural rules on when an appeal may be brought aren't driven by statute the way that these rules are. These reflect the intent of the legislature, and that goes to another element of statutory interpretation, and that is public policy. The interpretation of the legislature has consistently been, the intention, I'm sorry, of the legislature has consistently been to not allow judgment debtors to use procedural devices to try and evade judgments. One of those devices is evading service. And so—
Well, I understand the issue of evading service, which I think is a separate issue. I mean, your client waited until 10 years was up to start to seek renewal of the judgment. And arguably, had they started a month earlier, you know, you could have gone for publication earlier, et cetera. But I mean, I guess my question is, you know, if both an appeal period, I mean, an appeal period in some respects is a limitation of the time during which you can take an appeal of the judgment. The 10-year statute is a 10-year period during which, you know, you're limited beyond 10 years to maintaining an action on that judgment. And again, I'm trying to figure out why we would treat those two any differently.
Well, I guess what I would say is I would step back in here and say to the statutory interpretation question. I mean, we don't get into the question of whether or not, of how to interpret the statute, unless it's ambiguous. Now, the court's questions indicate that the statutes could be interpreted and can be interpreted as saying entry begins at step two, just as the court's question is suggesting. But it can also be interpreted, especially in light of 54809 and in light of the case law, as not commencing, the 10-year period doesn't commence until the docketing is complete. So that means there are two interpretations, and that's why we have to go into the candidate.
What about a situation where, I mean, docketing is not a mandatory thing, right? Entry of judgment is. I mean, the statute makes it very clear, the statute you're directing us to, 548.09, that the district court administrator must, you know, enter judgment. But there is no requirement. There may be plenty of judgments that are never docketed. So I'm back to your three-step process. I just don't understand how that is supported. Seems to me you can have an entry of judgment in situations where there's never a docketing.
And if there was never a docketing, or if docketing was unreasonably delayed, I think that would raise the possibility of latches for a defense to a judgment renewal action. But that's not what's at issue here. We're simply asking here whether or not, when does the judgment renewal period begin? And since a judgment renewal is an enforcement action, it can't begin until the judgment is enforceable.
Under your reading of the statutes, then we would have a situation much like we have here, where we have entry, so the judgment is valid for 10 years, and then on the last day there's docketing, which then extends that another 10 years?
Well, again, I think that if there was a docketing 10 years after the entry of judgment, I think that that would raise a latches defense to a judgment renewal action. But that's not what's going on here.
The only we wouldn't have to deal with latches if we just read the statute to mean it's valid for 10 years. You've got to get it done within that 10 years.
But 10 years from
Could you tell me again what statute says once you docket, you have 10 years from docketing to enforce, or is it a case?
54809 and all of the case law interpreting each of the statutes treat it that way.
All right, counsel, your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Patrick B. Steinhoff. I'm here for respondent John D. Klingelhutz. I frankly don't have that much to say because this is a pretty simple case. We have a judgment renewal action. That's a kind of action on a judgment. We have a statutory limitations period that applies to actions on judgments. That's 541.4. And that statute says that it runs 10 years from the entry of the judgment.
Can I ask
And then this, we have appellant's service.
Can I stop and ask you this? I want to pick up with something that appellant's lawyer stated at the end of his argument, that judgment renewal action is an enforcement action. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I think action on a judgment is something different than
Mr. Steinhoff, I'm having trouble with the audio. I don't know if it's just me or if my other colleagues are having the same issue. I can hear you, but it's delayed and a little bit distorted. I don't know if there's something you can do about that. Is there case law that would support your argument that an action to renew a judgment is not the same thing as an enforcement action?
I'm not sure that there's any cases that discuss the distinction. There are cases which address judgment renewal actions in the context of 54104. I guess the most pertinent of those is the Dahlin case. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, but it's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2011, 796 Northwest. I guess the issue in that case is whether you can renew a judgment twice. It identifies the action on a judgment. Maybe also the decision of this case, this court, which is Amica Mutual Insurance Company versus Wartman, 841 Northwest 2nd. 637, it discusses the distinction between a renewal action and a creditor's bill action, which was addressed in the brief. And I think if you read that, it's pretty clear that a judgment renewal action is an action on a judgment and not an action to enforce a judgment, which is what we would be looking at if there was a judgment lien, which there isn't. And if appellant was trying to enforce the lien on an asset, which isn't happening here. This is just an action to renew.
So the district court cited only the statute, which you say we shouldn't even get to, namely 548.09, the lien of judgment statute. What do we make of the district court's focus on that statute as opposed to 541.04?
Your Honor, I think there's a tendency among courts to use those interchangeably. If you read some of the appellate court cases, both of those statutes are cited as if they say the same thing and apply to the same situation. There's careless use of the terms entry and docketing. And to answer Judge Johnson's question, in my briefs to the district court, they were almost identical to my briefs to this court. I addressed both statutes for the reason that they're kind of used interchangeably. I think Mr. Steck cited to 548.09. And at the end of the day, they both say the same thing in this situation. They both say that a judgment lasts for 10 years after the entry. And, but the correct statute is 541.04. That sets the limitations period for a action on a judgment, which includes this action. 548.09 shouldn't apply at all because my client doesn't own any property in Ramsey County. There is no property on which there is a judgment lien. Therefore, that statute should not come into play. And I'm not sure why the district court cited to that statute rather than the first one, but it doesn't really matter because they're identical on the issue before the court. In addition to the plain language of the statute, which isn't ambiguous at all, we have controlling Minnesota Supreme Court precedent here, the Dahlin case, the Shamrock Development case, which Mr. Steck cited to. I think appellant's argument is basically based on I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, the Drewitz case, which is not a judgment renewal case. It's a creditor's bill case. That's a type of enforcement action. It's not a action on the judgment. So it should not apply. So the bottom line here is that we have a statute. It's not ambiguous. It sets the limitations period at 10 years after the entry of the judgment. Appellant's action was served after 10 years following the entry of the judgment. So the district court got it right. He cited the wrong statute. And I ask that that's all I have to say unless the court has questions.
Right. It does not appear there are any additional questions from the panel. Thank you. And we'll let the clock reset. And Mr. Steck, you may proceed with rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus on a couple of the comments that Mr. Steinhoff made. First of all, I'd like to call the court's attention to the authorities that do state that a judgment renewal is an enforcement action. First of those is note 2 on the Shamrock case that we've already discussed, stating specifically that a judgment renewal action is an enforcement action. Secondly, I'd suggest that the CNM Real Estate Services case that the court has already noted states that the right of action to collect the debt secured by a lien has not accrued until docketing happens. So that means that it's also part of an enforcement action. I'd also like to note a couple of other things that Mr. Steinhoff said. First of all, he noted that 541.09 and 548.09, I think I just said the wrong one for 541, the two statutes we're discussing here are treated interchangeably by the courts. Yes, they are. And that's exactly why we need to construe them in harmony with each other, because they're talking about the same time period. How long does someone have to renew a judgment debt?
And to the extent, Mr. Steck, that they do make a distinction between entry of judgment and docketing of judgment, I don't understand why we can't harmoniously read the two statutes and still conclude that renewal, the 10-year period during which an action to renew a judgment may be maintained, would flow from the original entry of the judgment. Why am I wrong?
That would be contrary, for example, to the Druitt's case that Mr. Steinhoff noted, where he said, well, that just applies to a creditor's bill. That was a decision under 54105. And it was saying that the 10-year period didn't start running until docketing. Now, he says, well, that was a creditor's bill and this is a different type of enforcement action. And that's true, but what would that leave us with if we were to say that it construes on docketing with a creditor's bill enforcement, but with another type of enforcement, it begins upon entry? We would then have two 10-year periods beginning at different points in the same statute. And that's an incoherent interpretation of the statute.
How, as a practical matter, is this an action to enforce a judgment when the complaint itself simply asked that a new judgment be entered?
Because the purpose of getting the new judgment entered and docketed is so that it can be docketed in a county where the person owns property. They're part and parcel of the same thing. You don't renew a judgment unless you're going to try to enforce it. For example, if a debt is discharged and satisfied in bankruptcy, then we don't have a judgment renewal on that, because even though the debt still exists, we have no opportunity to enforce it against that debtor. So what we're asking the court to do is to note that the real question here is, when does the period begin for enforcement of a judgment through judgment renewal? And since the real estate services case makes clear that there is no right that has accrued to enforce a judgment until docketing, and since the statute makes that, 54809 similarly makes that point, it is clear that there is no opportunity to enforce a judgment until docketing. Therefore, the enforcement period cannot be said to begin until after docketing. And for those reasons, we'd ask the judgment of the district court be reversed. If there are no further questions.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Steck and Mr. Steinhoff, for your arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you. We will recess now pending the second case scheduled for oral argument at 10:20.